And hello, everyone. This is Cameron Marceau with Black Liver Project doing another aromatic episode of Monster in a Glass, the podcast where we take a classic cocktail and we explore its origins, who made it and when they made it and why they made it and what they made it with. And then we look at the name or the background and do a larger historical discussion of the context for the drink. This episode, we are featuring a lovely drink called The Rose. I remember on Twitter not too long ago, I was complaining about Kirschwasser as being a really horrible ingredient. And like, how could you make a cocktail work with it? Because it's kind of it's a fussy ingredient. And I posted that, and cocktail historian Mr. David Wondrich sent me a reply saying, give the rose a try. And so I did, and it wasn't too bad. So there is that. It's made Kirschwasser okay. But before we go off into our regular exploration of the drink, I would like to thank one of our good friends, our family friend, for a Christmas gift that we received. Both Jay and I, who know this friend, Ms. Daisy Perdo, supplied us with two tiny bottles of Fireball Cinnamon Whiskey, the Nickelback of booze.
I want my Nickelback.
So, you know what? I've never had it. People decry Fireball whiskey all the time. They're like, that is nasty. It's horrible. It's a Frankenstein booze. Okay, maybe so. I assume that it is because it's like, I don't know, it's like melted cinnamon red hots or something. That's kind of what I assume. But I've actually never had it, and so I should stop assuming that it's terrible when I've never had it.
I don't know about you, but I'm ready to ignite the night.
Is that what it... with natural cinnamon flavors.
Night, N-I-T-E.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. That...
At least it's not K-N-I-G-H-T.
Ignite. Light them on fire.
Ignite the Knigget.
Oh, my.
Oh, golly. Cam,
you're going all in on that one.
Here we go.
I'm going to do halfsies here because...
I mean, it smells like cinnamon halfsies. Red Hots.
There was a third bottle of the Fireball that I got, and I was like... It was right around Christmas time, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to try to make an apple pie cocktail. We're going to use Calvados, and I think I used a little bit of allspice dram. Hmm. And I was like, we'll get all the flavors, all the Christmassy flavors. And then I put Fireball in it, because I was like, what else am I going to use this for? And it was fucking disgusting. It was...
Why didn't you put creme de menthe in there?
I should have put something in there. Because I was like, I looked it up and people were like, oh, you know, here's a recipe. But it was fussy. It had like egg whites. And I was like, I don't want to do all that. Yeah. I just wanted to taste like apple pie. None of them had Fireball in it. So
that's your own thing. That's your own creation.
I'd like to make a mixtape. None of them have Nickelback in it.
Or all of them have Nickelback.
Like a playlist.
It's just a Nickelback tape.
Nickelback playlist. That's to keep Nickelback out of all the other playlists.
Just put it in one spot.
Put it all in one place.
Right. It's called their album.
You put it here,
then
they won't show up anywhere else.
What's an album?
What's that?
All right, we're doing this. Oh, man.
Did it ignite your night?
I'm not excited about this.
There is nothing about that that's whiskey-like.
Or peeling.
Oh, my mouth is peeling.
Okay, so when I was
15... It's like watered-down Goldschlager.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, you're right.
Like, if I'm drinking cinnamon, I want my mouth to burn off and fall on the floor.
And gold flakes in it.
It's not as red hot as I was expecting. I was really expecting it. Ugh. I mean, there's a little bit
the
of
sugar
burn.
Side of it? Like, you wanted the sugary?
No, I was expecting it to be
super
more...
cinnamon?
To be more cinnamony, but it's really more sugary.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot of sugar in there.
It does taste. And like I don't know why they shot a box of Red Hots. I mean, like it's.
I don't know why they even bother calling it whiskey, though.
Is this a thing that people drink?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of popular, I guess. Like Nickelback.
It's kind of popular.
You know, when I worked, when I was 15, I worked at Frank's Nursery and Crafts, which I don't exist anymore. But there was this one section of the store that had lots of potpourri and candles.
Mm-hmm.
And that tastes
like a sack like of potpourri.
Have you ever been in a store that's purely potpourri and candles and essences, oils? And you go into the store and you're like, oh, this is really neat. And after like 5 minutes, your nasal passages start to burn and your eyes start watering. And
everything is.
Yeah, you're just being like, especially if you go around smelling different candles and stuff, and then you pretty soon everything hurts.
It feels like they boiled down potpourri and put it in a jar, and they were like, this is whiskey, right?
No, I expect it. I would expect that to be more, like, have a stronger, this is just, like, sugary cinnamon candy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did you see who the production company is? Sazerac?
Oh, Sazerac Company.
But didn't they have a factory?
Yeah, it's a brand now.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. They make Red Hots and whiskey?
Yeah, I guess so.
Jesus Christ. I can't get the taste out of it.
So we did that. So that's done. We don't have to do that again.
We did do that. Honestly, I bet you could, like, take a sock and douse it in that stuff and just leave it in the corner of your house and it'd smell great.
You're like, it smells like Christmas everywhere.
It's just Christmassy in your house.
It smells like it's grandma's candy bowl.
Then you wonder why your cat won't wake up. Because it ate the Fireball whiskey sock.
No. I want to share another experience that happened since the last time we sat together and discussed cocktails.
Do tell.
So I was at Target doing
some
shopping for the holiday. It was Easter. So I was in the Easter section with the children swarming around and the moms, you know, getting the candy and everything. And
everything was pastel.
Yeah. And everything, you know, and there's all the toys and crap and stuff like that. And I was walking around checking out different things. And I went down to check out something on one of the lower shelves. And, like, I bent down, and there was a horrible ripping sound.
I almost called it. Oh, my God.
I was about to say, like, what did you step in or sit in?
Total blowout?
No, it was my pants just ripped all the way up the back. And I was like...
And you rolled commando, so it was like, hello, Easter Bunny.
And I was... And, you know, and I've even lost weight.
Yeah,
I've
look pretty trim, actually.
I've lost, like, a lot of weight since in the past few months. And so, like, I'm like, what the fuck? Why are my pants ripping now? I'm in the middle of a crowded store with my ass hanging out.
And moms.
I'm like, oh, this is good.
You took off your shirt.
Yeah.
And yeah, whip, like, okay, whip it around. Let's just get this done.
And then the pedo alarm started going off.
All the way.
And you're so goddamn hairy, they probably would have thought you were the Easter Bunny.
You're like, no, that's my pants.
He's over there.
I had to get the stuff. I had to get the candy and things. And so, like, I just played it off. I was just like, oh, there's no problem here.
Could you hear it? Like, it was that loud?
I heard it. I don't know who else heard it, but I'm pretty sure everybody else. Well, I don't know if people saw. I don't know.
They weren't, like,
maybe
protecting
people were
their
checking
children's
out my butt.
Eyes and
I don't
stuff.
Know. I mean, do you often look
running
at people's
away.
Butts?
I mean, I try not to.
I look
to.
At Mickey's butt.
Yeah.
Like, there you go.
I look at my own butt in the mirror.
You know, I just had to finish my shopping and play it off like everything was fine and walked up to the register, and I have no idea.
So just pants and shreds, you buying Easter candy
yes.
at Target.
Yes.
So, like, how big was Rip? Like, was it just, like, your full ass would have been, like, showing or...
Well, I mean,
it
wasn't like cut out. It was like ripped. So it was like, you know,
shreds,
flaps, but like, it was like one big rip down the side of, you know, one cheek. So, like,
wow.
I don't know what it looked like when it was on me. You know, I assume people were seeing something if they were looking. So there you have it.
Well, did you have the leopard pants, the underpants on?
The Pinocchio.
The Pinocchio?
Yeah, the Pinocchio.
Wow.
So... But here's the thing. This is what makes it. That was one of four pairs of pants that I own. Now I'm down to three pairs of pants that I can wear. All the rest of them are, like, basically work pants, like for, like, gardening or, you know, to go to work in. I have three pairs of pants. So I'm in a desperate situation.
Don't bend over.
So I
I have to bend over
all the time.
Oh shit.
And I'm in desperate situation. I don't know if my
That's how you know you're getting fucked.
My other pants may go at any moment.
Because you're bending over all the time.
I mean, I might bend over tonight and duct these tape. Pants would...
That's the answer.
I just wear...
Preemptive duct tape. Just tape your pants.
Just the whole thing. The just whole have, thing. Just
you might as well make duct tape pants.
So,
Were they ripstop? Is that what happened? It went right up one of the seams of ripstop?
No.
Two solutions. Wear jeans. They're a little more resilient.
I hate jeans.
But also...
You're a chinos man.
Well, here's the thing. You know, I need more money to get more pants. So everyone, go to the Patreon page and subscribe to the show, because otherwise I'm not going to have any pants. I know we don't wear pants on the show, but I do need pants on a daily basis.
So there you go. Like, you just need to keep them in rotation. No pants, podcast time. Yeah, you just got to plan it up a little bit.
Yeah, I guess so.
You have nice legs, so maybe there's some pants off pictures.
Maybe we can have an event.
Yeah.
Maybe I can rip another
children.
Rip another pair of pants and
pants
on some other holiday and
like
then
the tearaways of the basketball. You just rip them off.
We can put it on the Insta.
Except
there's nothing
pants.
Underneath.
They're just khakis, like the whole
you with hilarious heart boxer shorts on underneath.
Yeah,
and you just tear them away.
We'll have an Instagram event.
That's what we'll do.
Yeah.
You need more pants, I think. That's the takeaway here.
Yeah, I need more pants.
You know, I don't think I own more than three pairs of pants either, but I wear jeans, so like, and I rotate them, so. But I have also sewed. I mean, I've had. Where I'm like, crotch is getting a little thin there.
Yep.
So, time to sew.
Sew them up. You got to be a ranger. You got to be able to sew.
Mm-hmm.
In the field.
You
sometimes
never know when you're going to
split
your pants, but also need to stitch yourself up.
Exactly.
If your crotch is getting thin, how do you stitch that?
Well, thin and then rips. And then I just, yeah.
Well, then if it's too thin,
so
then you
here's
can't
what you
put
do.
Thread
you take through. Old jeans. See, I got a whole system.
He grafts them on.
So, like, He's, old jeans
gene
become
graft.
Jorts.
You're,
and then
you're patching.
I cut,
oh, nice.
I patch. And
jean
then
to
I
jort.
Sew, so then
he
nobody
uses
can
the
tell.
Extra leg fabric as See? A stint, like a jean graft.
Look, this is a recycling tip. You get t-shirts when they get all
reduce, reuse.
Get all old, you cut the sleeves off. When you get jeans and they get all raggedy, you cut the legs off.
Yeah.
And then you patch your
He's saving the planet, goddammit.
What did you do?
You just ripped your goddamn chinos out at Target and scared a bunch of Easter children. Oh, mama. So maybe take the chino graft.
I just wanted Easter candy.
That's why I roll around with duct tape at any point. Just tape it up.
See, I admire that you were just like, well, shit, I gotta buy stuff, because I'd have been like,
I'm already here.
I would have been like, time to go.
You made the choice. You're like, I'm here. God damn it.
Yeah, people.
That's how you know you're old. You're like, fuck it.
Yeah.
My balls are hanging out, but I'm getting this fucking Easter candy.
You all can deal.
Right. Jelly beans
I'm not
or
up
nothing.
On these jelly beans.
Especially the black ones.
Oh, God. That's gross.
So, I'm joined here today by... my good friend, Mr. Jay Cruz.
Oh.
Hey.
Sound more excited.
Hey.
Than, you know, just, yeah.
Stuff. Hey there.
Whatever. We're also here with another great friend of mine, Mr. Mick the Bone Doctor Layman.
I can't get over the ripped pants. I love how you just completed. You just went through. That's how you know.
Who do I have left to impress? Really? I mean, come on.
I love it. That's how you know you're old.
Fucking. No, and for real, like, I feel like when I worked retail, that was the thing. It was like,
fuck it.
That dude's pants are basically around his knees. And it was like, he's 80. He's like, I don't
care. What is he
fun.
Doing?
Whatever. Yeah. I don't
hey,
care.
He's out of the house.
Yeah. He made it.
He made
That's
it.
He needs jelly beans.
I take the fucking CTA every day, man. I see that shit. I'm like, man, you made it.
Yeah.
All right. Good for you.
Things are looking up. Out of the house. No pants, but out of the house.
I like to get the news.
One step at a time. Even if it's a half step, because your pants are around your ankles.
That's right.
You're still stepping.
Yeah. So, the Rose Cocktail.
Here we go.
The Rose Cocktail. So, let me read the recipe first that Ted Haig gives, which is 2 ounces dry French vermouth, 1 ounce Kirschwasser, your favorite, and 1 teaspoon of raspberry syrup.
Rachel often calls Kirschwasser a grandma booze.
Grandma booze?
Yeah, it tastes kind of grandma-y.
I wouldn't say grandma-y, but it's harsh.
It's got some fire, but it's also got this kind of musky.
Oh, God.
It's musky fire. Is it like fire.
The tine one you made me drink that one time?
The
tawny.
No.
No, it's real. I had, when I was in Germany, we were at this restaurant, and I was like, oh, they have, you know, like Kirschwasser is like an after dinner.
And if you know what thing? Kirschwasser means, you'd
tell me, please.
You'd think that it would be really delicious.
Cherry water.
For the layman.
Kirschwasser. Cherry water.
I love the Germans.
But it is like...
It's not...
Burn.
You'd think it'd be like red water. Kool-Aid, you know?
So like if you lit grandma's drapes on fire and then tried to stuff them in your mouth?
Yes.
Nice. Yeah, pretty much. Yeah, it was harsh. I was like, I was like, I'm going to have a little tiny glass of Kirschwasser after dinner. And I was like...
Gross.
I feel like I can't even drink this, like, ounce.
Yeah.
It was so harsh. But, I mean, it wasn't bad. It was just...
Do you get some rose in there, or is it just bitey?
No, it was just... It was cherry bitey.
Cherry bitey.
Cherry burn.
Oh, gross.
This cocktail, the rose, was a giant pain to search for because, one, it's called the rose.
There's a lot of other stuff called the rose.
Yeah, nothing's called the rose. The rose cocktail, if we were lucky. Make sure I wasn't missing anything. I had to search for rose, which brings up things like rose water, rose syrup, rose cream, rose oil, rose extract, rose essence, rose colored, in addition to the Jack Rose cocktail, and a play called The Rose Cocktail.
Hmm.
And
a play?
There was a play called The Rose Cocktail. It had nothing to do with the drink.
Huh. Okay.
So right away,
It was a Gallagher style where they just shot Kirschwasser all over the crowd.
They smashed bottles of...
Yeah.
Suck it! My pants ripped out!
I'm smashing this bottle of Kirschwasser with a hammer.
With a giant oversized hammer.
So right away, there were also other rose cocktails that came up in searches with different recipes entirely. So an article by David Wondrich, which Haig points to as sort of the source for this cocktail, confirms that there were others, but he says that this recipe of all the rose cocktails is better. He also attributes it to Johnny Mitta, barman at Paris's Chatham Hotel, who he says knew what he was doing when he put this one together back around 1920.
So it's a Chatham in Paris?
There is a Hotel Chatham in Paris.
Wow, okay.
And that was from an Esquire article called Rose from David Wondrich from November 5th, 2007. So I could find mentions of rose cocktails as early as 1890. There was a newspaper article, the Fort Worth Daily Gazette from March 16th, 1890. It says, oh my, what was that? Whispered one rosy-mouthed young woman to her neighbor. That is a rose cocktail, was the reply. And what is it made of? Asked the neophyte. Why, whiskey, of course, answered the experienced one. They were, in fact, regular whiskey cocktails, some enterprising hostess having hit upon the poetic and pretty scheme of crowning each one with a pink rose petal and rechristening them in order to quiet the apprehensions of two fastidious young ladies. So basically, they're taking a glass of whiskey and putting a rose petal in it. Not a cocktail. Also... Not the rose cocktail we're talking about. So I want to talk about the
and not very inventive,
right? They were like,
just here's your whiskey shot with roses in it.
I when I was reading that, I was like, what it sounds like is two young women went into a bar and were like, I would like a cocktail, and they were like, here's a glass of whiskey, but we'll put it's got a rose petal in it there,
and it worked.
Your drinks, ladies,
and how.
Yeah, they're like, this is delicious.
This is amazing. Like, I can really taste the rose.
Quit eating the flowers. So I want to start with the earlier rose cocktail recipes. So the first place I could find a rose cocktail was in a book from 1910 called Toast, Wines, and How to Serve Them. gives the recipe of 2 dashes of Curacao, 2 dashes of Angostura bitters, 1/2 pony of whiskey, 1 pony of French vermouth. So not the recipe we're talking about by any stretch of the imagination.
I imagine there's tons of rose cocktails.
I mean,
because like, the word is just fucking everywhere.
So everywhere. Obviously,
we're talking like 4,000 BC. Yeah, it goes back. So yeah,
I mean, it's
what a nightmare to dig that shit up.
Well, it kept going, and I was looking even in like a, you know, I'm looking in cocktail books too.
Yeah.
When I looked at this one again, I was like, this is literally different than everything else I've seen. And then I was like, oh, the author's name is Randolph Rose.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
So I think that one was completely
shit, dude. Like author's names. Oh my God.
Or like past tense of rise. Like, who knows? You're fucked.
So there was a rose cocktail in Straub's Manual of Mixed Drinks in 1913, which had gin, grenadine, and orange juice, which also not related. Then we had Cocktailology, Drinks and How to Make Them from 1916, which has gin, French vermouth, brandy, grenadine, and lemon juice. Mm. And then Good Cheer, a handbook of recipes for spirituous and non-spirituous drinks from 1920 that calls for orange juice, grenadine, and gin like Straub's. We're not getting even close to the recipes here. Early on. And then there was one in 1922, Robert Vermeer, who has grenadine, dry gin, French vermouth, and Dubonnet. And he credits this recipe to Sidney Knight, the famous bartender of the Hotel Cecil in London.
So in all of these versions, do any of them stand out as having substance or persistence?
Not really. And I would say out of all the recipes, including the one we're talking about, none of them really stood out as like, this is the one that takes over. It was literally all over the place.
Wow.
Even the earliest recipe I could find that was close to the one we're talking about was 1922 in a French book called, here we go, buckle in.
Buckle up.
Croquest Recipes.
That's my favorite part.
For boissons, Americans prepare our exclusive event.
You just need
some. Avec des liqueurs bowls.
You need some more Fireball, I think. Just loosen that mouth up.
So at the end, you said with Bowles liqueur. So this is like a Bowles liqueur book.
So based on what they have here, they do have Kirschwasser in it, but they have gin, French vermouth, and Crème de Roses Bowles. Now, Crème de Roses Bowles, so as you mentioned, this is from the Bowles company.
Yeah.
Some recipes for American beverages prepared exclusively with Bowles liqueurs is what the book translates to. That one I was like, it's a little close, but not quite. Then I found it in Harry McElhenney's book, 1923, Harry of Ciro's ABC of Mixing Cocktails, which is the first place I was able to find information about Johnny of the Chatham Bar, Johnny Mitta. Mm-hmm. And he repeats this in his 1927 and 1930 books. He calls for 2/3 French vermouth, 1/6 Kirschwasser, 1/6 syrup grossier, which is red currant syrup. Mm. And he says, the original recipe from Johnny of the Chatham Bar, Paris. So that was the first place I was able to find that they pointed to Johnny, and also that was close to the actual recipe that Haig provides. So Haig points that he says, as for the drink, David Wondridge, the formidable cocktail guru for Esquire magazine, cites this iteration of the rose as the most lamentably forgotten cocktail. And so that's the Kirschwasser.
I see. Okay. Thank you.
So he is pointing to
David
Wendridge.
Digging up grandma.
We're digging up. A lot of these do sound like they were grandma drinks. Another rose cocktail from the Buckstone Book of Cocktails is half gin, cherry brandy, dash of orange bitters. 1926 Cocktails American. This is from Amsterdam. I was like, this is reading very funny. It's Cocktails American in Fancy Drinks, Eats Recepten and Drunken. And it has gin, French vermouth, Dubonnet, grenadine, and maraschino, which it might be maraschino.
Yeah, maraschino. Mm-hmm.
So that's from 1926. Rose cocktail from El Bar Americano in España from 1927. Mm-hmm. So they have orange juice. They have grenadine, and they have lemon juice. No booze. So this one was a minus booze drink. So the rose cocktail showed up in a lot of French recipe books. So we have the rose cocktail from Petit à grande berries, Choix des Meilleurs cocktails from 1927. Man, I wonder if, like, Rachel's ears are just bleed every time I read French. Just like, ah. So this one has gin, vermouth, and grenadine. Again, it's not really totally related.
No.
The next one I'm going to talk about had three different rose cocktail recipes, which two are close to the one we're talking about and one that seems totally unrelated. And then there's also a handwritten recipe at the bottom, which was kind of neat.
That's cool.
That had kirsch and vermouth, but also cherry brandy and strawberry syrup. So the first one has rose syrup, Angostura, grenadine, kirsch, vermouth, and then rose cocktail B has creme de rose bowls, kirsch, gin, vermouth. The third one has citrus juice, curacao, rose syrup, gin. And then they have a one that is handwritten at the bottom that has gin, vermouth, kirsch, syrup of strawberry, along with cherry brandy.
So does it taste like cherry or rose?
Well, yeah.
Am I off? Like, it sounds like they're going back and forth.
Most of the recipes seem to be putting in things that wouldn't taste like a rose.
Rose at all, yeah.
Occasionally I found things that they actually did say, like, rose water or rose syrup. But yeah. This was, for the most part, it was things like cassis, strawberry syrup.
You said currant at one point, too.
Yeah, red currant.
I think that what they're going is the after color? Is the color.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one is from 1930. It has, they call for a rose cocktail that has cassis fraisette, which is strawberry syrup, vermouth, kirsch, and gin.
Oh, yeah, look at that. Pretty. Salmon eggs.
Salmon eggs.
This drink is salty.
That's what it was all about. They were like, it's a rose cocktail. It tastes like salmon eggs.
Just like I thought it would.
The Savoy Cocktail book has multiple recipes for the rose cocktail, which is, and they call, the one we're talking about, he calls it the French Style Number 3, which has grenadine, French vermouth, and kirsch. Mm. Two recipes in the book that I'm going to talk about. The one is close, except that it adds gin, and they attribute it to a man named Santos at the Chatham. So they keep saying it's Johnny, but now this person's saying it's Santos. I found other ones that had Bacardi and orange juice. I had some that had Grand Marnier and gin.
But you're getting also all over the world too, right?
Right. Like
Europe,
French.
Well, Europe and America.
Yeah, and I specifically went to the French. There's a lot of French cocktail books online, and I specifically went to those because it seemed like a lot of the recipes were saying, well, this is the French style. So I went, and I was finding this recipe, but also other recipes for rose cocktails that were either the same or close to it. Like this one from 1938 was called Cocktails, Etc. They listed vermouth, kirsch, and gin, but also cassis and strawberry syrup. The book Cocktail de Paris, see, I did that all right.
That was all right.
Has two different recipes, including the one we're talking about. And they had cherry rocher, which is a deep cherry red liqueur. In this one, they have a rose cocktail that has kirsch, vermouth, cherry rocher, and syrup de groseillier. I don't know how you pronounce it, but they attribute it to Albert at the Chatham. So now we have three different bartenders that they're attributing at the Chatham over a period of 10 years in the 20s.
Huh, okay.
I didn't find that many recipes in the 20s. There's quite a few of them in French recipe books, but not really in any others. Into the 30s, you start to see more rose cocktails. But again, there's no consistency. In 1932's Art of Mixing, you have the vermouth, gin, syrup, grosset. And then you have also in 1933, Jack Grohusko, Jack's Manual, has orange juice, grenadine, and dry gin. 1934, My New Cocktail Book. They have, again, the four variations that pretty much the Savoy Cocktail Book. PGD has a rose cocktail English, which has lemon juice, grenadine, brandy, vermouth, and gin. And then the French Style Number 1, which has brandy, vermouth, and gin. And then the Number 2, which has cherry brandy, kirsch, dry gin. And this kind of goes on throughout the 30s. You keep getting close. Some have gin and cherry brandy. Some have French vermouth and kirsch. Some have grenadine, but there really was no consistency. Some had Like this one from 1936, Wines, Cocktails, and Other Drinks, has apricot liqueur and grenadine. There's one from 1943 that is a Spanish one called Cien Cocktails that has Kirsch gin and French vermouth. And a little bit of grenadine. It's kind of all over the place.
How different is Kirsch and grenadine?
Very different.
Yeah.
Like sweet?
Grenadine is very sweet. It's basically just like
syrup,
red
right?
syrup.
Yeah.
Like it's, pomegranate.
It's pomegranate.
Oh, okay.
It's super sweet.
Okay,
and
yeah.
And it turns everything bright red.
That's like, what I thought when I think of it. It's like violent red
yeah.
and super sweet.
And Kirsch is clear.
So that's a pretty big difference
yeah.
in flavor.
I mean, with this recipe, you're going to have raspberry syrup or syrup de grisé, which is red currant. I mean, it's going gotcha. To turn it red anyway. But so grenadine would be a good stand-in if you're just using it for the color.
Mm.
In Emile Bauen's 1949 book, Livre de Cocktails, has like 7 different recipes and attributes almost all of them to different bartenders.
Oh.
So he has one with grenadine, citrus juice, gin, French vermouth, and apricot brandy. He attributes it to Harry Craddock at the Savoy Hotel. Then he has grenadine, gin, brandy, and French vermouth. He has gin, kirsch, and cherry brandy, which he gives to the Grand Hotel in Paris. Grenadine, kirsch, and vermouth. Grenadine, gin, French vermouth, Dubonnet, which he attributes to the Cecil Hotel. And then he gets down to syrup grisé, French vermouth, and kirsch, which is Johnny. He calls it Johnny Chatham. Johnny Chatham Bar. And then he has one for raspberry syrup, French vermouth, and gin, and he attributes it to Frank Meyer.
And the Ritz.
At the Ritz, yeah. And after the 1940s, it doesn't really show up in many places. As we've gone on, there's like no consistency to any of the rose cocktails that show up. I just noted a couple that came up in the 60s and 70s. One from the UK Bartenders Guild from 1965 says, there are several versions, but the most popular to be found in Paris where it was invented is as follows. 1 teaspoonful of de rose syrup, kirsch, dry vermouth. I can't say that that's true.
It seems like the syrups are changing. So like our recipe has vermouth, kirschwasser, and then raspberry syrup. So you can put in your currant syrup, you can put in your rose syrup.
Mm-hmm. And they're just that's really red is, yeah. I mean, cherry brandy or Dubonnet, it's going to be turning red.
Well, specifically cherry herring.
Into the 1970s, there was a recipe for a rose cocktail that seemed to combine all of the rose cocktail recipes ever invented. It had orange bitters, sweet vermouth, dry vermouth, cherry brandy, kirsch, gin, orange peel, and maraschino cherry. I don't think that was related other than they were like, let's just put everything that was ever mentioned in this one.
It came in a bucket?
Dump it in a bucket. What do we call it? It's red. So as we've talked about, I mean, why the name rose? I mean, I think obviously what's happening here is that you have grenadine, you have other red syrups, you have Dubonnet, you have, you know, cherry brandy or herring, which would give it a red or pink color depending on the amounts that you put into the recipe. I don't think it's like a major leap to say like, well, yeah, it looks like a rose. It's a rose color. I didn't see anything else that indicated that there was any other reason. And to me, it seemed pretty obvious. And in some cases, they did reference the color, not necessarily saying, this is why we called it the rose, but more that it was like, it will give it a nice rose color.
And I specifically also, a rose because roses are so prominent. I mean, there are other pink flowers.
Right. And, you know, and there were so many other drinks that called out a rose. I found things like the pink rose, the Irish rose, the wild eye rose, the morning rose, the Bermuda rose, and all of them that had rose in their names, with the exception of the white rose, which obviously that would be stupid if you put something red yeah. in the white rose. All of them had a red component, like something that would turn it red or pink. If you have any red stuff, especially grenadine, like I've put grenadine in drinks, even just a tiny bit, and it's just, it's boom, it's pink.
Yeah, it's over. Like, yeah.
It's bright pink or red.
It's and a super dye.
I'm going to say that the color of the rose is why it's called a rose cocktail.
Yeah.
Which it's interesting that some of them actually went with the rose flavor, you were saying, right? So that's kind of unique.
Those came later, and I feel like that was more of a, oh, well, it's called the rose cocktail.
What a strange taste, that's what I'm saying.
Yeah, so like, we're going to put a little bit of rose water. Or
like the color wasn't syrup. Enough for you, you got to make it taste like grandma.
And it might, maybe it tasted, I mean, to me, that would probably make it taste entirely different than having some kind of like fruit juicy red syrup in it.
Yeah.
At first I was like, are these recipes related? But it was just turning it red, basically. And they were like, yeah, it's a rose cocktail. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were some that had French vermouth, but then some had gin, you know, and it's like, well, those are different flavors. So I don't know. I don't pink think drinks. They're related any at all. Yeah, right. I really think it was just more about the color. One of the things that you noted was like that David Wondrich was like, hey, try this one. And mm-hmm. in his article, he talks about it like how it is a truly forgotten cocktail.
Well, that's because it didn't exist as a single
entity. Right. But the recipe he's talking about. And I was like, well, yeah, I mean, like this one, it kind of came and went. Like you would see it. But it didn't stick around. It was never, out of any of them, I wouldn't even say it was the most popular out of, or at least the one that showed up the most. I wouldn't say this particular recipe showed up
well,
the
no
most.
One could point at it.
That's true.
I mean in any book, any yeah. publication, it was different.
Yeah.
It's like, okay, so if you go to a bar and ask for a rose,
yeah.
the bartender can't know it because it's so variable.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the customer has to be able to tell the bartender. And if there's so many different versions and you have 10 customers with 10 different yeah. versions, the bartender's not going to learn it.
Makes sense why you get someone, some of them are non-alcoholic, just juice mix.
Yeah,
you
know? Yeah, because like, it's like, make it pink. Juice. Right, yeah. exactly. Yeah. I think it was totally a forgotten cocktail. And, you know, I thought like, well, at a certain point, I noticed there was no consistency. I thought, well, I'll get into the 50s and 60s and 70s and there will be other rose cocktails. There really wasn't. I mean, it was mostly callbacks to previous rose cocktails, reprints of other books. It's just about the color. It's just about the name.
Like, and so you know, if there isn't even a thread of one,
yeah.
then it's hard to say which one is the rose cocktail.
Right, exactly. And he kind of talks about that. I mean, he mentions like there were tons of rose cocktails, but this one is the one that he thought tasted the best. But it was really kind of a forgotten cocktail. He mentions that we have Johnny Mitta, created this in the 1920s. And I was like, okay, so that's somebody to work with. But we also came across somebody named Albert, and we came across somebody named Santos, who they give credit to rose cocktails. I couldn't find anything that verified that any of this information was correct, or that any of them worked at the Chatham Hotel, or that Johnny Mitta even existed. Hmm. I did find in David Embury's 1948, The Fine Art of Mixing Drinks, he says, here's a cocktail that was highly popular in Paris during the 20s and early 30s. My good friend Frank Meyer, for 30-odd years the manager of the Ritz Bar in Paris, states that it was invented by Johnny Milta of the Chatham Bar in Paris in a compilation called Cocktails de Paris, published by La Maison des Cocktails of Paris in 1929. A slightly indifferent formula is credited to Albert of the Chatham. There are also several other formulas, both French and American. The distinguishing feature of all the recipes, of course, is the rose color of the drink. Here are the several various formulas. So he gives an explanation, and I think that's the best one. He says that Johnny, he calls him Milta, had the Kirsch, vermouth, and raspberry syrup. Albert of the Chatham Bar had cherry liqueur. So it was basically the same drink, except he had a cherry liqueur. So I think that it's possible. I mean, if they were all working at the same bar, maybe they made variations on it.
I just want this to be like the Pink Panther serving me this drink.
You ruined the surprise. It's the Pink Panther. It would be
the drink is
a little
pink.
Bit darker than the Pink Panther, I think. But yeah. Maybe not.
Well, not if you cut him open.
I know. Inside, much darker.
And drink is delicious. Goo.
Could you cut open the Pink Panther and put that in a glass?
right away. Wee wee.
Wee wee. So I'm good at French.
I got you to say wee wee.
So when I was looking at this, I was like, oh, Johnny Milta. All right, fuck yeah. I got a name. David Wondrich misspelled it. That's why I can't find anything. I literally couldn't find anything on this. Then I went back and I found, I was like, there was nothing.
That's like, because the other guy misspelled it.
Literally nobody misspelled it.
Well, there was a Johnny Milta or a Johnny Mitta.
There was a person, yeah.
So probable. Somebody misspelled it.
Yeah, somebody misspelled it. I think it's this guy, and it was probably David Wondrich has the right name, just because I saw Johnny Mitta more places. But who knows? It could have been either or, because I didn't see this person's last name, really, other than this book. And I it would be weird that David Wondrich would read that and go, no, this guy's misspelling it. So he must have done some other work. There's probable, based on the research that he tends to do.
Yeah.
He knows somebody who knew somebody that worked at the bar. You know, like that it got passed down. All in all, though, I really think that it's probable that this Johnny created the drink. But I don't think it was popular enough. I don't think it really made a blip. And so it's, when I was looking around to find anything on the Chatham Hotel or Johnny Mitta or this drink, it's just nowhere. And so it was, and it, you know, that happens. It was just like, it's not that important. Nobody was really talking about it. I found things on the Chatham Hotel, but not even that much. But, you know, I thought, well, wow, I mean, this must have been a fancy hotel. But barely anything. I mean, a couple of things just to give you an idea of what it was like. There was a book called Pleasure Guide to Paris from 1900 that says, the bar of Chatham Hotel is overcrowded at the time for port and cocktails. One of the smartest rendezvous in Paris, more especially frequented by the racing world. And then a book called The Guide to the Restaurants of Paris. If you want to be extravagant, go to the Ritz and dine in the garden after you've had a cocktail at the bar. Or down the Rue de la Paix, around the corner on the Rue Danau to the Hotel Chatham, or to Ciro's where Raymonde will welcome you. And then 1927, Paris with the lid lifted, luncheon in garden of Hotel Chatham. A surprisingly beautiful setting, right in the center of the Rue Danau, and across the street from your beloved Henry's. You step from the sidewalk into a large garden and lunch or dine, mid flowers, palms, and fountains. If it be winter time, who says
If it be winter time. Winter is coming.
A pirate rose. If it be winter time, the scene shifts to a very kitchen itself.
A rose.
Where you walk up to the chefs, select just the particular
raise
chopsticks.
The pink flag. What the fuck does that mean?
You know, basically they were talking about how fancy it was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did find an article from the Morning Oregonian from 1912 that says, American drinks are served. A somewhat smaller but equally attractive and equally convenient in point of view of situation is the Hotel Chatham on the Rue Danau, running just between the Avenue L'Opera and the Boulevard de la Madeleine. I'm really
good. It's awesome. I love it. You gotta like watch like 101 Dalmatians just to like get bad French accents, yeah. And then just
or
kill
just
it.
Sit with me
and just kill it.
You know, it's funny just when it,
make it up.
When I was sitting here and I was researching this, and I started laughing, and I told my wife, I said, "This is going to be a real good one.
This is a good one."
There was a lot of French in this, and I started reading it. And she was like, "Stop,
stop, just stop. Stop.
Parlez-vous francais, nond?"
I teach music, so a lot of musical terms are Italian, so I just do like really bad stereotypical Italian accent, and I actually had like an Italian fluent speaker once in class, and they were like, "You're a dick." Like, we don't talk that way. And I'm like, "What are you talking about? It's a forte piano." They're like, "You're an asshole."
Like, "I'm gonna kill you." I basically couldn't even find a lot about this hotel for as much as, like, they said, like, it, you know, it would show up in a lot of guidebooks, but in a list. They'd be like, here are hotels.
Yeah, right.
You know, it
was not known for the pink cocktail that...
Exactly. There wasn't, like, a thing where people, which we have seen...
You gotta try the rose.
Yeah.
Right. So yeah, good. Oh, none of that. Not even, like, I mean, they would be like, you go to cocktails here and get a bite to eat, but it was non-specific.
It's kind of like asking for the orange.
I feel like a lot of the drinks that we've had where it has these kind of generic names where the recipe just is different all over the place. I wonder if, considering all the bartender stuff that we found that said, like, you don't talk to the customer. You basically just do what you're told. You're a servant. You get them what they need. If there was a lot of that where people would be like, yeah, give me the orange, and they're like, fuck.
I don't want to think about it.
Okay, yeah. What would make this orange?
Right.
Like, I'm not going to question that. I'm just going to do it.
Yeah, here we go.
Like, the rose is an easy one. You're like, shit, put pink.
Something red.
Something red will make it pink.
Yeah.
All those nosebleeds coming in handy.
Yeah.
Oh, no.
Don't order the rose at the Bucket of Blood.
No.
You're right, yeah.
Bar. You will get a really bad
drink.
Everything's
a rose at the Bucket of Blood.
This tastes like iron.
Irony. There wasn't too much to this one.
No, there was a ton.
Too much. Like, there was too much to
there,
this.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, basically.
And
yeah.
Why? Because roses have been in history forever because they are the flower of all time.
I would say they're the
flower. Everybody loves roses.
They're the flower.
There was only just a very short period of time when people weren't going, oh, roses. Roses are great. Roses are the best flower ever. There was literally just like a period of maybe 500 years where people in a region of the world, so we're not looking at roses.
Was this hipster land where they were like,
no,
I'm the only ones that we're the only ones that don't like
roses. No, it was roses, it was Europe during the Dark Ages.
That's what I was going to say. Everyone was dead, so they couldn't talk about flowers.
No, no, it actually is very similar to the reason why they weren't drinking milk back then. But
so fucking out. Like, don't explain that at all. Let's just let that hang out there in the world. They really didn't like frogs either. Next subject.
I mean, it's very clear. They didn't like roses. They didn't drink milk. They don't like frogs.
For the period between 1824 and 1826, frogs were out of vogue.
If you don't know what that means, you're not in the club.
No, during the, like, so shortly after the Roman Empire fell, and Christianity was taking over, a lot of learning was gone. And anything associated with paganism, they didn't want to touch it.
Taboo.
So and milk. There were so milk. Many, there were so many references to pagan mythology and Roman culture. The Romans loved their roses. When Christianity became the new thing,
it was a slapback.
Roses were out because they were associated with paganism.
As bad as disco.
So, like, milk had the same thing happen. It was there were references. People drank it.
Weird.
What the?
And so
milk?
Yeah. Yeah. Were you not here for the milk punch episode?
I must not have been.
No, you were.
No,
you were.
Was
you
I?
Were complaining about it.
Okay. Yeah, so, don't put milk in booze.
Yeah.
I can just...
No,
But like, so, what, Romans bathed in milk or something? Or
they were drinking it. They had a little bit more familiarity with it. There were references in their mythology. It had a connection to the Romans.
Gotcha.
Who were pagans. So that's
they would
so
like
that symbolism is
tilt
out.
Cows on their and shoot milk from the udders
no,
at each other and
no.
raucous toga parties.
No, but this is not the milk punch episode. Okay. Everyone go roast, listen to the milk punch episode to find out about the milk punch. So the deal with
but that's the only time.
Yeah, right around that period of time. Otherwise, roses are everywhere and everyone loves them. So the oldest rose fossil is North America. 40 million years ago,
holy
from the Eocene period.
40 million?
40 million
that's
years
amazing.
Old.
So, that's amazing.
So that's the oldest known evidence of a rose.
I just want to kick humanity in the balls. Because it's like, oh yeah, you're so cool, except for this rose has been around for 40 million fucking years, you know? They got to figure it out a little bit.
Except after that, they lost their foothold in North America. So
so
they're not really indigenous to North America, so to speak. I mean, the evidence
there's
is
evidence,
there that they were
but
here,
it's not,
but they didn't stay in North America. There's also evidence of roses 25 million years ago in China. So that's another, and China has had roses consistently. Yeah. The reason why there isn't as much fossil evidence is because roses usually grow in dry areas, and so there's less places to make... Well, also less places to make impressions. Because usually it's in wet areas, mud, and stuff like that. So there's no way to create an imprint. That's going to solidify.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So they could be everywhere. It's just the places we see evidence was the one place that there was an imprint left.
Exactly.
Cool.
Exactly. But the oldest roses in Europe, there are basically two that were indigenous and really popular before... There was a spread of species and varieties and breeding.
Mm-hmm.
There were the Gallicas. They were the deep red ones. And then there were the Damasks from Asia Minor. Mm-hmm. So those are the ones in the Middle East.
Do you have a color for the Damasks? Or?
I think that they were also red, but they weren't the same blood. Deep. Yeah. They might have been a little bit more pink.
Yeah,
earliest,
they were pink to light red.
Earliest depictions of roses were ancient China, Egypt, and Greece.
Cool.
The word rose comes from the Latin rosa, which came from the Greek rhodon. It's also related to the Isle of Rhodes. Their coins have roses on them. Some of the oldest presentations of roses in art, pottery shards from Jiangsu, China, 3500 BC.
Wow.
With five-petaled flowers. They're not 100% sure that they are roses, but, you know, they could be.
Mm.
Confucius references roses in his writings in 551 BC. He says that there were roses cultivated in the imperial gardens, and there were also records of roses growing wild on the palace walls in China that were started in 2737 BC.
Hmm.
So they were growing all the way through that period of time.
Growing on the walls. I mean, that seems almost like, could it have been a protection thing too? Like, I mean, they're beautiful flowers, but they also have brambles and thorns. Like, you know, if you let them grow wild, it seems like that would be...
You're not getting through it.
I mean, not that the palace necessarily has to be protected in that way. I'm sure they had, like...
But it wouldn't hurt.
With swords and shit, but like...
Good deterrent, you know?
It's pretty and it hurts people.
I'm sure that just the flowers themselves were the true value.
But it would be funny to find out that it was actually a fence.
They were like, cut those goddamn flowers off.
Like, yeah, what's...
We need thorns.
Well, after a while, they become historic. I mean, they've been around for over 2,000 years.
Pretty fast. By
900 AD, China was breeding them and growing them a little more actively. In Greece... There is Minoan jewelry in Crete and paintings from 2800 BC, frescoes at the palace. The Assyrian king Sargon had rose trees in Akkad in 2845 BC. And apparently in Persia, they had the most roses. It was
perfect climate, huh?
All of the royal gardens. Semiramis, queen of Assyria, grew roses in her garden in 811 BC. The royal garden Pasargadae in Iran. Cyrus the Great had roses, 558 BC. Here's something interesting. They had, outside of their garden, they had this land that was just filled with roses. So it was just bright and brilliant. And there were some Greeks that traveled. And this land was called, in Persian, Pairai Dezeh, which meant around the wall. So like outside the wall of the garden or the city. And the Greeks heard it and called it Paradisos.
Oh, cool.
They use that word to mean paradise gardens. Mm. So it's the origin of the word paradise.
Mm. Huh. That's really cool. Just meaning pokey wall.
pokey wall.
Beautiful pokey wall.
Egypt also had roses. They found some rose buds from, I think it was around 3000 BC in some digs. So they had roses, but they were known for extracting the scent through smoke. And in Latin, the Romans said it was perfumum, which meant through smoke.
Oh, cool.
And that's where we get the word perfume.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
By 1570 BC, the Egyptians were using it for roses for religious ceremonies and honored guests. During the Ptolemaic period, so Ptolemy was one of Alexander's generals, and Ptolemy got Egypt after Alexander died. They were extracting rose oil and using it to anoint their bodies before war and anoint the dead.
I can see the dead part, because you're like...
Less stinky.
Dead the smell. Yeah. Like, you'd be like, this smells good. Let's put this on the dead bodies.
But have a whole army of... Yeah. Beautiful smelling sweaty, soldiers.
Sweaty and like, soldiers. I mean, would that just deter war? They'd be like, you smell really good.
Let's
like,
just talk it out. Like,
I don't really want to stab you. I kind of want to just smell you for a little while.
I want to sniff you. Then they stab you in the face.
Right.
When Cleopatra met Mark Antony at one point, as he got off the boat, his path was strewn with rose petals that were knee deep.
Damn.
That sounds stupid because you're like, I can't fucking walk now. Yeah, thanks.
Well, it was a great expression of love.
Too much. Too much.
Right. Garbage.
Greek and Roman mythology and poetry. Roses are everywhere. Yeah. You can't not see roses. For them, it was a symbol of love, passion, purity, excess. Because people could have roses like crazy. The rich people, the senators, the merchants, the warlords, just roses everywhere.
Yeah.
It was also war, death, and the fragility of life. So, like I was saying, the Romans were using a lot of symbols. They were using roses in their religious rites and everything. And so when Christianity came, it was no roses. Soldiers wore... rose chaplets after war as kind of like an honor.
What is a chaplet?
It was like a shoulder piece.
Okay. Ooh, so like it wasn't like chaplet. Small chaps.
Yeah. No. Rose,
assless. They only show chaps. A little bit of your ass like a rip.
Are you a target?
Yeah. I have to get the jelly beans. The Romans placed a rose on the forehead of the departed. Then if we go out east, Zoroastrians, Ahura Mazda, their god of good, was associated with roses. One angel, Din Parandin, was associated specifically with the rose. and the rose is said not to have gained its thorns until the dark god Ahriman arrived and gave the rose its thorns. Hmm. Roses in the Muslim world. So like they were already grown in Persia when the Arabs and the Muslims came, they quickly took them up and they started making rose water in vast amounts. When the Muslims took Jerusalem back from the Crusaders, Saladin ordered that all of the sacred buildings in Jerusalem be washed entirely in rose water. Wow. It was 500 camels carrying gallons and gallons of rose water.
Wow.
And apparently when the Hagia Sophia Cathedral in Constantinople was taken by the Ottomans, the Sultan did the same thing to that cathedral, washed the whole thing in rose water.
Interesting. What a weird cleansing.
For Christianity, during the Dark Ages, like I said, the whole thing was dropped. Part of it was the association with paganism. Also, Christ's crown of thorns.
Oh, yeah, that's a...
Okay, so you've got that.
That's a sticky subject.
Also, there was a story about a rose that allowed Satan... It was climbing up the cross. A rose that was climbing up the cross, and Satan was allowed to climb up it to heaven.
That's a story.
So, rose is bad, but because the rose is so damn pretty, it started making its comeback by the 3rd century.
Like, yeah, but it looks good and
yeah,
it smells good.
So and pretty. It looks good. And,
why
yeah.
am I hating on this thing?
And it's just a rose. Yeah, the white rose.
Change it to a daisy that climbed up yeah. the cross.
Dandelion. Never fuck recovered. The dandelions. Yeah, dandelion. It was never a dandelion. Never That's recovered. A Satan's flower.
Never recovered.
White roses were associated with Mary's virginity. Red roses with suffering and compassion.
Yeah, I was going to say there's got to be some like cult of Mary thing going on there.
Yeah. She was known as the rose without a thorn, yeah. And that was what brought roses back in was the Mary associations.
That's really weird that it would be associated with Satan climbing up to heaven, and then it's like you have Mary. She
about
you know,
that
she was the rose without wrong. The thorn, and you're like, I mean, well, I know that like over time it's just like no roses.
Yeah,
cool,
there were
right?
there were a
it's
couple really cool there were a couple hundred years, and people weren't reading.
Mary's yeah. cool, so, and
like you know what are cool roses?
Women like roses for birthdays mm-hmm. and stuff. Right. So
actually, side note, I just heard this thing, and I don't know how true it is, but that the reason the King James Bible was written was because King James was known for having homosexual affairs, and it was his way of getting
his
get,
agenda,
like, distracting.
His agenda on the book.
He was like, oh. You know what you should write is a Bible, because they were like, there seems to be a lot of weird stuff
oh,
with
wow.
you and these other men, and they were. He was like,
don't pay attention
write a
to
Bible.
That.
And they were like,
here's what
right.
you need to do.
And
it worked.
I was like, I gotta look more into this, because this sounds really. It's like that would be amazing to be like, stop looking over here, and write a Bible, huh. And name it after me too while you're at.
Of course.
Like, oh, yes, sir.
I'm not taking a bath.
With the page boy.
With the page boy.
And roses.
What chapter are you on?
Right. Have you written about Jesus yet?
Remember, Mary likes roses.
Charlemagne discovered rose water from the Muslims, and then he really liked it. A whole lot, and so he imported lots of rose water, and so by 768, roses had made a full comeback.
Let me ask you this: do you guys like the smell of rose?
Yeah,
it's fine.
Have you ever?
I don't.
Have you ever steeped roses in water?
I don't like the smell.
If you take a red rose, like red rose petals, drop them in boiling water.
Yeah,
it turns the water blue.
Wow.
Turns the petals white, and then it tastes like rose. It's delicious.
Wow.
I wouldn't say it's like one of my favorite smells, but I don't mind it. I mean, it's fine.
I'm going to have to do some like deep hypnosis to figure out
why
I
hate
roses so much. Yeah, I really don't.
Because you hate God and
Mary. Part of your genetic history.
Pretty much.
There was a rose planted by Charlemagne's son, Louis the Pious, on the wall of Hildesheim Cathedral in 818 A.D., It grew there and survived through World War II, even though the cathedral
they
was,
gassed it.
Was bombed.
They bombed it?
Yeah, it was destroyed, but the rose is still there.
Wow.
In 1265, the Dominican friar Albertus Magnus had a banquet for the Epiphany for the Holy Roman Emperor, and he had a whole spread of roses at the banquet. And that's when wealthy people really started going for them even more.
Mm.
So that's 1265. At the same time, right around that point, the Crusades start, and so you've got French knights out in the Middle East, that's rose central at that point, because the Muslims never turned their back on the flower. So there were tons of roses and different varieties. They're getting things coming in from China. Then the French start bringing them back, and it makes France the capital of roses.
In Europe, like that's in Europe. The Europeans saw it that way.
Exactly. They killed these people, but they got good roses.
Yeah. Well, that's the way the Crusades were. People went over there and they're like,
a bunch of shit.
They know how to live here. The first Crusade, they went there and the weather was better.
Man, this ain't so bad.
But they're evil.
Yeah, exactly.
They're like, what if we never go
The food
go
was
back?
Better. They had fruit. They had spices. They had and
they took baths.
when the second Crusade came, the Crusaders were like, dudes, stop it. Like
what are you doing?
The second Crusade came. And all of the first Crusaders hanging out in Jerusalem. Yeah, and
they were like, let's set up a bank.
They were hot tubs.
They were
roses. Chill.
They were wearing...
yeah, that's the thing. Every successive Crusade was like, dicks, we want some of this action.
Mm-hmm. No, they weren't. It was... They came in thinking they were going to save Jerusalem. And
there was nothing
And
to
when
save.
They get there, there's all of these knights hanging out in Arab garb.
Yeah.
And wearing...
Assimilated.
Yeah, and they're like... No, this is like the best place ever. You know, they're hanging out with the Muslims. Everybody's getting along to some extent. There's still conflict because you have to conflict. You know, you have to put up that.
Right.
But for the most part, everybody's living in harmony, except for the holy knights like the Templars and the Hospitallers. The knights are doing pretty well. And when the other Crusades come along, they're saying, chill out. Don't fight because you're just going to screw it up.
Yeah.
The Templars were doing a banking thing and making tons of money,
so much money
from it. They were sending stuff back to Europe and stuff like the roses. To some extent, France owes its rose connection from the Crusades. And it wasn't that they just went and stole them. They could have even dealt for them because they were doing business with them. One of the biggest collectors of roses eventually was Josephine, Napoleon's empress. She tried to collect every species that was there, and she had a huge garden at Malmaison.
I wonder what the variant, like how far back that kind of stuff goes, and color and shape and stuff.
It starts really China? Taking off in, well, you're getting roses from all over the world once the Europeans can travel. And so by the 17th, 18th, more like the 18th, 19th centuries, you get the people who are breeding them and getting the different varieties.
Yeah, they really started
thousands upon thousands of different varieties, naming them, putting them into contests, and then, you know, it really exploded. And
sky's the limit.
Even went to North America, where there's tons of roses. And for a time period, North America became kind of the leader in roses. Oh, rosaries. Okay. There was a Spanish priest, Domingo Guzman. He's Saint Dominic. He received a vision of Mary in a cave where she created a garland of 150 roses that shrunk into beads or rosebuds on a necklace. To this day, there are rosary beads made of rolled rose petals.
Seen that?
Yeah?
Yeah.
What do they look like?
I mean, they're going for that bud look.
Are they hard? Are they? Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, some rosaries will, they're not a bead at all. It's like a bead that looks like a bud. Like,
really?
Yeah, like a rose is cut in, like it doesn't look like a bead at all.
Huh.
Looks like rosebuds.
Okay.
Yeah.
By 1470, there was a Dominican friar, Alanus de Rupe, who was the first to use them in aiding prayer. 1040, the Pope created an award called the Golden Rose. So Pope Leo the Ninth created this gold filigree rose studded in precious stones, primarily rubies.
Where's that thing?
Well, one was presented each year to a ruler who demonstrated outstanding faith. So there are multiple roses.
Where are those?
They're in the Vatican. Box. In a bouquet.
Right, we're taking all of these back.
These
sorry.
Gold roses studded with jewels, and they appoint them to different rulers. It was a high honor.
Ask for them back?
Or took them?
No, they just kept them, but they'd say, this is in your name.
Oh, I
for
see.
Being... A great.
They're like, thank you.
God,
no, you don't get
you
to
don't,
keep
you
it.
Can
sorry.
Look at it.
Yeah.
You can come to the Vatican and look at it.
Eventually, it became something that the popes they gave to the queens, and the kings got something called the sword and the hat.
The sword in the hat.
The sword in the hat. Yeah. I don't know. I should look that up because that sounds weird.
Is that it's a Harry Potter thing.
Yeah. And then now to this day,
it's also probably dirty. It's probably like, don't worry, you'll get the sword in the hat. Sword in the hat. I don't want the sword in the hat.
Now the golden rose is only for shrines.
They still hand them out.
Uh huh. Wow. Apparently, I don't. It doesn't sound like it's a big thing. It's probably more emblematic at this point because
it's a sticker.
Yeah. Good for you. It's a gold
scratch
star.
Like a rose. Nice.
Smells like golden rubies. Alchemy.
Here we go.
Because the rose is a five-petaled flower, it is the base for a pentacle. Okay. Perfect. Also, it's known as the magician's flower because it's related to mystery. Because Eros, he protected Aphrodite's secrets through giving out roses. So it's related to mysteries and secrets. There's a term sub rosa, which means under the rose. It stands for confidentiality. That's what that means. And they think the term for that comes from a group of Greek soldiers that hid under a bunch of rose bushes when Xerxes attacked. And they came around from behind. Also, with the secrecy thing, there would be roses on ceilings. So if you see one painted or you see one hanging down, that meant that secrecy was required in the room.
Ah, little cue there.
Today, you'll cone still see light fixtures called ceiling roses.
Ceiling roses. Huh?
Yeah, so if somebody references a ceiling rose in a room,
mouth.
Well, it's now it's just a fixture. People say it all the time, but they don't know why it's there.
Is it?
Well, look at my rose fixture. Wink, wink.
Does it just have a camera in it? Is this an Airbnb thing?
It's a Rosicrucian thing.
Nice. Those guys were hip.
Well, it's the same thing.
Here we go.
Christian Rosenkreuz, rejection of the material world for the spiritual, and it's all connected to the mysteries. And because of the pentacle, the flower, the mysteries of Eros.
You ever see the Rosy Cross? Check it out. There's a lot going on there.
It's just a flower. Like, I feel like that's a lot of reading into a flower.
Yeah, but people were doing it because...
Well, I know. I'm just saying, like...
Have you, Jay, ever looked into a rose? No, it's a perfect flower for mystery because there's so much folds and depth.
Royalty using roses for their badges, their coat of arms. A ton. There's a ton of them. The first one who did it was Raymond Berenger IV, Count of Provence. He was so honored by receiving the golden rose from the Pope.
Oh, cool.
That he adopted it in his badge, carried on through the family line.
I mean, everybody was like, that's cool.
Yeah. And then other people started doing it. Then there's the Tudors, the red rose and the white rose. Queen Elizabeth was known for having roses everywhere. Embroidered in all of her clothing, in her imagery, in paintings. Yeah. Have you seen paintings of her?
I haven't seen it. I was going to say, like, now that I'm catching up on Game of Thrones, the House Tyrell. Is their symbol is the rose, and there's the matriarch of the family is basically like, look, you got a wolf, you got a lion, what do we got? We got a rose. This isn't a strong symbol.
Right.
But it seems like it was.
Yeah, and it stands for so much. And people just adopt it willy-nilly. There was a resistance organization against the Nazis that was quickly stamped out. It was called the White Rose. Why? I don't know. It was in Munich, but, you know, it's like, why are you picking a rose?
Right.
It just stands out. Everybody's doing it. The British Labour Party. It's a red rose.
Huh.
Started as a red flag. Too commie-like.
Mm-hmm.
So they adopted a red rose.
And they're like, you get it, right? I mean, you rich people like roses. So we're not that
so it's okay.
Right.
The British
communism light.
Yeah, the British rifle regiments, the Yorkshire Fusiliers wear a white rose, the Lancastrian Fusiliers wear red, Anglian Fusiliers wear red and yellow, particularly on August 1st, commemorates a battle.
Like really complicated, like you wear this rose. Yeah.
Hey, that's our rose.
On the August 1st, one of the Lancastrian Fusiliers has to eat their rose. From 1768 and on, the rose breeders were full on. And they were getting roses from all over the world and creating thousands of different breeds, including tea roses. Have you ever seen a tea rose or smelled one? It smells like tea. Those come from China.
Never heard of that.
Rose garden in the White House. Rutherford B. Hayes. He started it, went through many different versions.
The most famous of presidents.
Yeah, that was his
Legacy right there.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Rose Garden.
But the one that's there today, that was designed for President John F. Kennedy. He had a friend design it for him.
Present one that we're familiar with.
Yep. That's yeah. I believe Eleanor Roosevelt tore down the one that Hayes made because they were putting in the West Wing or something. Roses are everywhere in literature and song. I mean, think about all the different songs we have with roses today. It's stupid.
It's like an ubiquitous symbol. Yeah. Like, it'll just fit in whatever you want it to be.
Do you know what the colors of roses mean?
I know some of them, but not all of them.
In the 19th century, it was known that if you received a white rose, it was saying, I am worthy of you. A red rose meant you are a priceless beauty. And a yellow rose meant I know of your infidelity.
Or you smell like pee.
You smell like pee. Yeah.
Both.
I know of your infidelity and you smell like pee.
Nanner, nanner, nanner.
To me. And to me, you smell like pee.
And today, the industry of roses and cut flowers and stuff. Apparently, there's a ton being grown in, like, Colombia. And basically, I think in Venezuela, too, I think they said.
Well, not anymore.
Basically, they're all grown hydroponically, and they can be shipped anywhere in the world in 48 hours.
Holy moly. Mm. That's our globalization
right
there.
So you're talking, it's huge business. In Turkey, they're making rose water and rose oil.
Imagine.
Massive amounts because the fields are huge.
Yeah.
Yeah. Really, I would say the big things that happened were where they grew naturally in the Middle East. That was Middle East and China.
Mm-hmm.
Through the years in trade, Middle East and China started swapping roses and creating more breeds and stuff. And then the Crusades brought them even more back to Europe. I mean, they were already in Rome and in Greece, but they really became a thing through the Crusades.
Well, the symbol of them, too.
Yeah.
Not just their pretty flower, but like...
Well, I mean, it's a pretty flower, and then you want to create a symbol to match it. Mm-hmm. You want to relate to it, and especially the knights. And a lot of their symbols, you know, initially they started as hard imagery, but they needed to soften them, especially for like their helmets and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It was better to wear a rose on your helmet than a spike.
Why?
Knights and stuff that had metal dragons or metal things on their helmets, they'd get their necks broken when they'd be jousting. If the opposing knight was able to set the point into the...
Something.
Yeah, it rips your head back and breaks your neck. So that's when they started wearing feathers and flowers and stuff.
I wondered that, because you can't... I mean, it tears out.
Yeah, it's not going to rip your head off.
Well, that's a hard lesson to learn. You look fucking cool in that helmet.
You know, man, it's easy. Like 30 times, so we're like, you know, this is probably not a good idea. Roses
are a better way to go. I don't know. Do you guys have any relationships with the roses?
I bought some recently, but that's...
You just go out and automatically get them for Valentine's Day?
No, I mean, it was Mother's Day, but it was mixed in with other things. I don't, like, seek out roses. I don't think they're particularly special in any way. I don't know. I'm just like... This looks fine. This looks good.
I don't like the smell of them, but the shape of them is incredibly intriguing to me. It is like one of those shapes in nature that is just pure mystery. Because it's enveloped. And it's almost like a fractal dynamic with the spiral.
Mm-hmm.
And so the way that the petals are distributed, I think, is like Fibonacci or something like that. It's very close. Or the golden mean, it might be one of those.
Yeah.
And so it just sucks you in when you look at a rose.
And that's why they're used so often in cathedrals and temples, in mandalas.
Yeah, you know, it's like you get those flowers geometry.
And you just spiral into it. You
it's
just
a labyrinth.
Go in. Yeah. And that's something that helps promote meditation.
For sure. Absolutely.
Because you can get lost in that shape.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. They put that in, on the floors, things like that, so you could walk them or walk a labyrinth, you know, just to meditate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that just dovetails with prayer and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So, cool shape. One of my favorites. Check out the Rosicrucian thing. Those guys were nuts. They were as kooky as Pythagoras.
They didn't believe in the material world. At the heart, they were all about the spiritual nature of existence.
You know, it's in my limited studies, it's a lot like the Gnostics. Like, they were tapping into that whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which some of the real strict historical Jesus folks were like, yeah, he wasn't about what that church stuff ended up being. He was more about that spiritual awakening.
Well, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. It makes total sense. But you can't create a structure based on that kind of randomness.
For sure. I mean, it's about individual freedom And that doesn't control people.
Nope. And you can't create laws that, that everybody can associate with.
For sure. It's hard to attain as well.
The other day we did a Show Us Your Cocktail that had rose syrup in it. Mm. It was hibiscus tea, rose syrup, and vodka. Mm. And it was delicious.
I bet it was good.
Yeah, and this one, I mean, it is pure color. So that's the funny thing is, like, it could be whatever.
And it seems like it's going to be, it's really very basic. You know, you've got your vermouth, Kirschwasser, and then a sweet red syrup. Mm-hmm.
Looking at the proportions again, there's mostly vermouth. 2 ounces of dry French vermouth and then 1 ounce of Kirschwasser, which seems counter. You would want more ounces of the stronger booze. I always feel like vermouth you have less of.
Yeah, typically. Drink.
But yeah, this one has like the flip, but I guess Kirschwasser is...
Kirschwasser is so harsh. Yeah. I think the
fresh vermouth is. I'm gonna have to try this one. I think
it's intriguing.
The Bernie drink.
Cool. So I've already had one of these. It was good. I'm looking forward to sharing it at the tasting and seeing what happens. So onward.
The Rose. 2 ounces dry French vermouth. 1 ounce. Kirschwasser, 1 teaspoon raspberry syrup.
And we are here at Ward 8 in Evanston, Black Liver Project's Liquid Playground, and we are going to try the Rose. I'm joined here by the lovely Mr. Jays Ranville.
Hello.
Jays?
Yes.
Do you have a favorite Rose or a Rose story? Is there something in your life
that is tied to a Rose?
When was the last time someone gave you a rose?
Someone gave me. I don't know if I've ever been given a rose, unless we can all count the rose that truly matters, Rose Nyland of Golden Girls. And is she not a gift to us all, really?
I'm also here with the lovely Mr. Eric Martin.
Hello.
Eric, when was the last time someone gave you a rose?
I think it was in high school after some kind of musical performance or something like that.
What color was it?
It was red. That's what the concession stand was selling. So.
Ah, okay. Okay.
Maybe the concession stand was sending you a coded message.
Well, the colors are significant.
Yeah, right? I'm just saying maybe the concession stand had feelings for you. It wasn't ready to admit.
At least it wasn't a yellow one. Ooh.
Is that like gifting someone a green hat?
What's the green hat?
It means I'm sleeping with your wife.
Really?
Wow. That's what I've heard.
I kind of want someone to give me a green hat now. I'd be very confused.
I'm just thinking, now that awkward look my neighbor's been giving me for a while is really making more sense.
We're also here with the lovely Ms. Nicole Pizzini.
Hello, hello.
And you, when was the last time you received a rose?
Probably the musical in high school thing, honestly.
Are you...
But you asked my favorite rose.
Yeah, what's your favorite rose?
That was your original question. And there is a rose garden within walking distance of where I work.
Yeah.
And it's exactly 15 minutes to walk there and back. So, like, instead of a coffee break, I'll just go look at all the roses.
Wow, that's cool.
And my favorite one is called Peace and Love, which is a nice title, and it smells really good, too.
Do you know how old it is?
When it
was first bred, when they were... Because there was a period of time in, like, the... Well, actually, it's probably about 200 years... 18th and 19th century when they were just going crazy with
varietals. It's a hybrid tea rose.
Okay.
1991. Bred by Ping Lim. Now you know.
Fantastic. Okay. Have you smelled it?
Yes.
Smell like tea?
It's smells like no, it doesn't smell like tea.
That's what it's supposed to smell like. That's what
really?
Yeah.
Tea roses are. I thought that you had them at tea.
Nope. According to the source I read.
Yeah.
They had an aroma of tea. And so that's why I asked you, because I'm reading all of this stuff and I have no actual.
I like the scent of this one because instead of being like a really like heady floral scent, it's a little apple-y. There's like a little brightness to it.
Okay.
Interesting.
That's part of the varietal. There's like thousands and thousands of different ones.
It's amazing what making hybrids of flowers can do. I mean, I guess with like dogs, we kind of do the same thing. It's like one species.
Yeah.
And we've made such a variety.
Yeah.
Roses are like that. Orchids are like that.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
I am a fan of rose water. I really do like. I non-ironically like rose water.
What do you?
Like as an ingredient?
Yeah. Like, what do you do with
like
it?
Like as a drink.
Wow.
You drink it?
Yeah. Yeah. It's like it's big in the Middle East.
Oh, it's huge in the Middle East.
Yeah. You drink it. It is like a. It's exactly like what it does what it says on the tin.
I get rose water and orange blossom water mixed up. Are they similar or are they totally?
One is made with roses.
Ha!
But is
but I think like orange blossom water is usually like really condensed and bitter. Like,
yeah, it's
you wouldn't
really
just drink
harsh.
It.
Rose water, it is like okay, you know the like vitamin waters that you can have that are vaguely flavored. Lightly flavored, like I've usually heard him as described as like a strawberry, but on low battery.
Yeah,
it's kind of like that. It's you're definitely drinking water, and then you have this sort of rosy aftertaste or rosy almost aroma in the taste of the rose water.
That,
but you also can get people who make it really, really like they'll sugar it up a lot.
Sure,
like hibiscus.
What's that? Yeah,
like hibiscus.
Yep.
That makes me think of the cherry blossom flavoring you find in a lot of. Japanese stuff too.
Yep.
Very floral. Well, sometimes not very, just lightly floral.
Yeah.
But now this drink doesn't have any kind of floral flavoring though, it sounds like.
No, it doesn't.
Right? It's vermouth, which just tastes like brine. And oh god, that cherry brandy.
Kirschwasser.
Lord.
Yeah, we've had it before and
it's like fire cherries.
It's hard to tame. It's more than just fire. It's got this kind of musty flavor that it isn't. Oh, and the drinks have arrived. Rose cocktails. So, Jason, what do you... did you try this at all?
I did.
What do you think of it?
It's pretty nice. Like, it's definitely like a really like dry, nice, light, dry cocktail. But, yeah, that's pretty good. I'm trying to explore it further, I think. Yeah, I don't know.
Very cool.
Thanks, man.
Enjoy. The pain on your face, Nicole. It says it all. It is really a hard one to mix because we've tried it before, and we say it's way too grandma. That's what.
Yeah.
And also, it's got raspberry syrup. Tonight, Anders is using. He substituted Frambois.
They do smell a little bit like pickled grandma.
Pickled grandma. Everyone's grandmother does at one point. Have her house smell too much like roses, I think.
Yes.
I think it's a requirement of becoming a grandmother.
Well, these drinks look lovely.
Because these are missing the raspberry syrup, I'm guessing that the original recipe would be a lot pinker.
Yes.
In the book it is, but, you know, when we look at the book, when there's a red, they never come out as red as it shows in the book.
That's true. Like it would probably be at least like a blush color with some raspberry syrup.
It is more so, yeah.
They're catfishing us in the book with their cocktail photos.
Yeah, totally.
Or they're just using more artificial coloring than they do here at Ward 8.
Yeah. I mean, you do if you do a natural grenadine, it's not that red. Red dye number cancer that they use.
Didn't realize we were already having a vermouth drink.
Nicole's got a martini bumper. It does smell musty. It has the... Kirschwasser bit to it, but well, it plays well with the vermouth, but then I feel like the fruit does a good job muscling it.
It does taste a bit of musty grandmother.
Yeah.
Pickled grandmother.
But you know, the vermouth really does, I think, tame.
I would say that's not as strong of cherry as I was anticipating.
We've had a Kirschwasser drink, I can't remember what it was, and it was not received well.
Mm-mm.
The smell really reminds me of a salad I had in Boston, which had pickled green strawberries and goat cheese. It's just that, it's like...
Oh, you're that guy.
A briny... I am that guy.
Yeah, own it.
Proud of it. But it has that briny, fruity smell. The mustiness isn't like a mildew mustiness. It's a nice, fruity, full-bodied...
Yeah. We could even call it, like, woody.
Yeah.
I would call it woody. Woody would be an adjective that we could stumble into.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It doesn't taste like an orchard or anything, though. You know, no, like, you'd think, like, fruit and wood, but
nor
no.
Does it taste,
no.
Like, particularly floral at all.
No.
Roses do have a woody stem.
They do have a woody stem. As a fan of cherries in general, I actually like that this is not... it's not cherry Kool-Aid. You know, I'm not drinking, like, a cherry... It's not a cherry cordial. It's not something that's, like, a sugary, sweet cherry drink. But it definitely has a cherry taste to it.
It's vaguely, it is vaguely raspberry, but it's not overdoing it. Not at all.
I like that we're getting fruit without getting sweet. Mm.
Absolutely.
It has a slightly viscous mouthfeel to it. It's smooth. Mm-hmm. It coats your mouth. It lingers. It finishes with more fruit than it starts with.
Absolutely, yeah.
This would be a really good... I do too. This would be a really good... This would be a good drink to serve at, like, a wedding.
Oh, especially if you had, like, the blush color to it.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Her colors are blush and bashful.
Blush and bashful.
I think that this is a lovely color.
It's
dark.
It's not really rose color, you know.
Well,
when you're seeing
coming.
The world through rose-colored glasses, this isn't the color.
Yellow rose-colored glasses.
Yellow rose. Like, kind of like urine-colored glasses.
Oh, gosh. I'm suddenly less optimistic.
I'm more optimistic.
this isn't urine-colored. It's a little... It is more blush than that.
Yeah, we're not getting good light. I feel like it's very subtle, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And that's what I like about it.
Well, that's what I was kind of thinking, like, I said wedding, but I was also thinking, like, if you wanted to be really fancy, this would be like an afternoon tea drink.
Oh, yeah.
Because
this would be good with tea. Because then you can have, like, a floral tea also.
Ooh, wow, yeah.
And it's light. Yeah. It's not a heavy drink. It is...
I mean, it's a boozy drink.
It's a boozy drink, but it's not, like, I don't know.
It's not smacking you in the face with flavor, which is what I was expecting. From that cherry brandy.
I think because it lingers so much, you'd want something that had a bit of saltiness to it that could cut through.
Oh, like a shortbread cookie.
Again, would be good if you are the type of person to host afternoon tea, this would probably be a good drink to have.
So then
now I might have to be.
Cucumber sandwiches, right?
So that's is that what this pairs with?
I think so.
The food pairings.
Yes.
I would say anything you would drink a wine with, this would probably go with as well, so cheeses or other charcuterie.
Probably not a steak.
Probably not a steak. But something light, like a first course sort of thing.
This doesn't seem like you'd want to have meat with it at all. Any kind. Not fish, not chicken, not...
I like the tea time theme. Kind of sold.
Again, I would say this would be like cucumber sandwiches would go with this.
Boiled tongue sandwiches.
Boiled tongue.
Is that what you eat at tea time?
That's a British staple for tea sandwiches.
I would eat that.
It's not bad.
It's like pulled...
Yeah, it's just
meat.
It's beef. It's mild beef.
It tastes you back. It's okay. It's a little hard to get over that, but once you do, it's fine. Mm-hmm.
These little glasses look like little tea glasses, too, you know, because they're kind of small, little up glasses.
There is a vaguely grandmotherly sense about all of it, right? Because everything's kind of, it's served in like these kind of diminutive glasses.
It feels very big, like a cordial.
Yeah. I think maybe that's why I'm defaulting to like as an afternoon drink, you know, because this is not the thing you would go order at a bar at a rager or something when you really just wanted to go out and have fun on Saturday night. This is
you stir up in a bucket.
Yeah. This is not coming to a SIGEPS party near you anytime soon.
It's absolutely something I would get when I was craving vermouth. For example, today I got a martini because I wanted something vermouthy. This would be a good substitute for that.
Yeah.
And the ingredient list is pretty small, so if you knew the ratios, you could make a good one of these pretty easily.
Yeah.
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 Now, most bars probably don't have that raspberry syrup, though, right? Like, you can just walk in somewhere and order a rose. People will look at you like you're crazy.
Well, they'd be substituting another syrup or finding... Like in this case, Anders used a raspberry liqueur, a light raspberry liqueur, as a stand-in. So I'm okay with that. I think that the raspberry syrup probably would have made it a lot more sweet.
It depends how much was used, yeah.
It was a teaspoon.
Oh, a teaspoon? No, yeah. You'd be fine.
That's just for color, mainly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so. So is this punchable?
No.
This is not punchable in any way.
Not even... A little.
In any way.
I mean, it would be easy to make in quantity because there's only 3 ingredients, but you will kill all of your guests.
Yeah, I'd say the distinction is this is not a punch, this is a batch drink. This is absolutely something you could make in a pitcher and serve.
I'd still be nervous that people would pour, like, big glasses
well,
of it.
Well, like, I mean, you have to supply the...
And would you get the same effect with the color? I mean, you could mix the... The Kirschwasser and the vermouth, and then you'd have to put in.
And then
in
you'd add in the. Yeah, you just add in
the. Oh, yeah. You just like put a little dollop of the raspberry in the bottom of each cordial glass.
Yeah.
You'd want some kind of effort put into this because otherwise people would just be pouring it from the spaghetti and just drinking it way too fast. It is very smooth.
It is, surprisingly.
I could down one of these without feeling it for 5 minutes.
Yeah, it is very drinkable. And I was a little concerned because of the Kirschwasser. But yeah, this is approachable.
I think it's coming back to a lot of menus. I think that people are trying to find new ways to explore all of these really distinct flavors. So we'll probably see it in trendier cocktail lounges and things like that.
And it has the advantage of, even if some of the ingredients are more obscure, their shelf life is infinite.
And they're not that, and again, there's only 3. It's not like it's a lot.
Right.
This is not something that you need to have a real, real, like deep bench necessarily in order to make or to have around.
Yeah, and it would be, you know, if you've got a busy night at the bar, it wouldn't take too long to make. It's not like an Alamaguslam or something. That's...
Yeah.
Are there easy variations on this that could be made with other flower names?
You could use different types of syrups or liqueurs.
Could you do a lemon syrup and call it the daisy or something like that?
Probably.
The daffodil?
Could you add some kind of, like, heat to it and call it a spicy rose?
This so, Rose Nylund in a cat suit.
That's Rose Nylund.
What we found in terms of the history is that there are a lot of cocktails called a rose cocktail because there were a lot of bartenders back in the day who would make a red or a pink drink and they would... And a rose is a easy place to go.
Mm-hmm.
And there's so much culture and so much meaning behind that flower that... And the recipes were all vastly different. It was so this one rose to the top in our book. I don't feel like it really had a lot of impact to the whole cocktail scene.
I can see why this would not be a drink that would set anybody on fire. And that's not necessarily as a knock on it. It's tasty. It's easy to use in a couple different settings. I don't see anything about this drink that's so dynamically new or dynamically distinct that you would have people being like, oh, I need to try one of those. I need to have that.
And yet the aviation took off, which is just a martini with some creme de violette, you know?
Yeah.
So,
like... Fair.
Well, it took off now. The right people saw it and put it on menus and made it big. And it's a very captivating drink with the color and the way it looks and everything. So it becomes popular really quick. I bet if you presented the rose in a certain way to make it look as interesting as the aviation.
Instagrammable.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. How do you make the rose Instagrammable?
You
well,
add
you'd
a raspberry.
Obviously need some petals.
Yeah. That'd be great.
Yeah.
Actually, yeah, if you added like some rose scent to this beverage, could really... Yeah, and I don't really like floral flavors, but...
Maybe even just a squirt of rose water.
A mist.
Or something like
rose oil around the rim or something.
You guys are missing the Instagram, though. You can't smell rose oil. You can only smell rosella.
You can't smell rose oil?
I know. I mix my words up. I'm drinking a martini.
So you're doing lots of plant stuff, aren't you, Nicole?
What?
You're doing lots of plant stuff, aren't you?
I am. Yes, though ironically, it's mostly tropical plants because it's in a greenhouse.
Wow, okay.
So there are no roses there. And this was so sweet. So Jeremy knows that I'm really excited about taking care of this little rooftop garden I have going. And he sent me a picture today after he walked the dogs because he saw, like, this neighbor had a flower in their front yard. And he was like, you should plant this one. This is nice. He's helping. He's, like, trying to participate. This is wonderful. And it was a rose mallow, so it's slightly on theme. It's hibiscus.
So tropical plants.
Mostly, yeah, because it's a Victorian conservatory. And so the Victorians were all about collecting plants from places they had conquered.
Oh, yeah.
And putting them under glass. Mm-hmm. So lots of tropical.
Taking things that were living and thriving in their own environment, removing them from everything that made them alive.
Yep.
And then congratulating themselves on what they've done.
Yes. Very much.
Victorian way.
Uh-huh. They killed a lot of orchids that way because they didn't know how to actually keep them alive, so they just kept stealing more. We're better about it now.
That sounds like England.
So there's got to be a metaphor there, right?
No nice ones.
But yes, come see our plants, especially when it is super cold out. The Lincoln Park Conservatory is a great way to go experience some humidity and see things growing January in Chicago.
Humidity is really refreshing in the middle of winter.
It is.
Right now, not so much.
Not so much now. So I'm doing two shifts every month, which sounded really appealing when it was going to be like January, February. But in July and August, and the only air conditioning is open the windows, mm-hmm. it gets steamy in there.
Yeah.
Do you really find humidity stimulating in the winter? Heat, I understand.
No, humidity, absolutely.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, because it's dry out, too.
Okay.
I turn into a lizard in the winter.
Yeah, I just start shedding my skin.
Yeah. I get bigger each time I shed a layer,
right,
too.
Right,
so.
Right.
I want to be an iguana in my next life. I just get to sunbathe and eat fruit all the time. And then sometimes when I get too cold, I get to scare tourists by falling out of trees on top of them.
Those are goals.
I mean, right?
I mean, we can find
ways to make this happen. That sounds like some Instagram personalities anyway.
Just
sunbathing and eating fruit lusciously. You know?
Yeah, there's no reason you can't live that life now.
I don't see why this is. I don't see where the barrier is in this personality.
I'm pretty sure you could probably have a tail grown and attached to you.
That sounds less convenient for my current lifestyle, but when I'm climbing through trees, it'll help.
Think of all the alterations she'd have to make to her pants.
I guess she'd switch to skirts.
Or stop wearing bottoms entirely.
I mean, if you're falling out of a tree, you might as well give them something really good to scream about.
Jesus.
I am not a humidity man, even in the winter.
You guys, the reason they're painting the roses red is because the two warring houses in War of the Roses, one was red and one was white. And so the whole painting the roses red is totally a thing. It's like, oh, new monarch, gotta switch the roses.
Oh.
I mean, they didn't literally go out and do that, but
right. The
symbolism was there.
Yeah.
The Wars of the Roses is one of my favorite period of British strife, of which there are many. And my favorite Kathleen Turner movie, her and Michael Douglas.
That was like back
she
in
played,
the 80s,
she played a middle-aged right? housewife, and she was 33. Wrap your mind around that one.
Yeah, sounds about right.
Yeah.
Just think of all the cultural references that we understand in our media today that people in the future will have no understanding of. Imagine someone in the year 3000 watching Shrek.
Will they be watching it on? DVD?
VHS, duh.
It'll be right in their brain. It'll just... They'll have a
plug-in. Oh, yeah, Cam's ready for the wet link.
Yeah, I want the wet link. I'm ready.
They'll be watching it on a boat.
There you go.
Oh,
I was
going to
say, ironically, they'll be watching it on Betamax. Turns out that format war is not quite done yet.
So why do you like the War of the Roses?
Why do I like the War of the Roses? Like the actual War of the Roses
yeah,
or the
yeah.
movie The War of the
yeah,
Roses?
Yeah, what's... What do you like about the...
I'm very at home with warring families. You know, that just feels like a growing up thing. Also, just because I really do enjoy saying Plantagenet. I don't get as many chances in my life to say that as I would like.
Go hog wild.
Plantagenet Bay. And I think everyone knows this by now. I think anyone who's watched it can realize that Game of Thrones is the War of the Roses.
Oh, yeah.
Like, that is very much where it came from. It's also just a really horrible period of history of which the British are solely responsible.
That's a lot of history.
It's a lot of history.
I don't know. It was a lot of, like, a proxy war, though, too, between, like, France and Scotland and Burgundy. Like, they were all kind of...
Yeah, everybody was messing around with stuff.
Yeah, a lot of folks were like, just keep being at war with each other so that you don't have to attack us.
Right. Yeah. Right. I mean, fair enough. We can talk about that, the global aspect, but I'm still going to lay this at the feet of the British. I don't know. It was one of the first like wars I think that I ever read about as a kid that was not like the ones you hear about in the United States, like the Revolutionary War, the Civil War. All right, Revolutionary War, that sounds big. That sounds exciting. Looks okay. A lot of movies about it. Civil War sounds like a bad test, even though, ironically, I actually really like the Civil War now as an adult. But the War of the Roses, that was some good branding. Just some really, yeah, really good
That's
branding.
Cool.
Yeah.
But, I mean, you think... I mean, was it really... It was just a bunch of royalty fighting each other
right.
for
yeah.
control and basically ruining everybody else's lives around them.
Right.
Well,
like the Civil War, no, it's like a serious like conflict on a nation.
No, but during the War of the Roses, the nobleman actually ruins less of the general populace because they wanted control over it. So they didn't want to destroy all the stuff because they're like, no, I want that thing. So let's not destroy that thing because I want it to be mine.
I'm also just
so
a fan.
So there's like less destruction than usual for wars. Yeah.
Okay.
I'm a fan of any time in history when the people who are starting and propagating wars, which tend to be the wealthy, and in this case the powerful, or the nobles, are just for once being kind of blatant about what they're about. You know, like they're not trying to hide behind some nationalism. They are purely being like, look, we're dicks, but we're dicks that want to keep these castles, and that's really what we're about here. And while we're at it, we'd like your castles too. And this is not about for God or country. This is not about an invading force, and we have to protect our good, honest English people. This is really about because we need a new castle.
I think what you're describing, though, is really the way it has been up until the last 300 years.
Yeah.
It's always been just, I'm the king, I'm a dick. I get what I want.
Yeah.
That's it.
Sure, but my point is that in a lot of times you end up... These stories get wrapped up in some noble cause. They get wrapped up in the idea of a foreign invader or in sort of the doublespeak version of it, which is...
Like you're talking about now?
Well, now, but even going back beyond
that. I don't think that they cared to make excuses.
Well, like the Crusades, for example.
Crusading
That's
England,
a good
like
example.
The Anglo-Saxons, like the Norman invasion, all that... You get that sort of like othering of this foreigner either coming into your soil or the doublespeak version of the foreigner is not coming to our soil. We need to come onto their soil to stop them from coming onto our soil.
Yeah.
Which is also a common thing. It was at its core, these two families who just didn't want to get along. It was like the equivalent of the families who now fight over whether or not you can cut down the spruce tree to put up the fence. That's really what it was. Only a lot more cannons.
And just like a lineage dispute.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
The way you were describing it before, where they were just looking at each other's castles, being like, I want that one, I want that one. That sounds like House Hunters International.
It is a little bit. I think it's
the modern century edition.
The modern descendant. That would make a good spinoff. Let's do House Hunters International with the War of the Roses, with the leaders of the Wars of the Roses. He's a nobleman. She's a married woman from a lesser house. He invades countries. She knits. Their budget is unlimited. Plus the blood of peasants. You can just, you know, they're going to be like looking at this castle from a hill, you know, and one of them is going to turn to the other and be like, I can really see us on that parapet just drinking wine at the end of the night, you know.
They always say that.
Pissing on the commoners. farting in your general direction.
Right. I do have to ask for people who watch House Hunters or House Hunters in general, how much wine do you people think you're drinking?
I mean,
I'd want to drink a lot if I were in their situation.
I pretty much bought my current house because of all the wine I'd be able to drink on the roof.
So you were that. You would...
And it has paid off.
Okay. Or put you further in debt, depending on your perspective.
Are you and Jeremy going to plan a hostile takeover on the building next door?
A hostile takeover of where?
The building next door.
You know, they don't have a roof deck yet.
Well...
But, you know, a couple of planks and a fence could fix that.
You could have a boarding party.
This could be.
Oh, my God.
This is what I'm talking about.
So swing good. Over to the other building and
you
storm
see
it.
You should be buying a bunch of, like, rope and wood. You know what I'm up to.
Grappling hooks.
Yeah.
This is exactly
powder.
What I'm talking about. And in, like, four generations from now,
oh my gosh.
Like, your relative familial descendants will just still be fighting it over.
The people on that third floor are going to be like, man, the raccoons are big this year.
Slowly take over the whole block.
Oh my God. What a great idea. Their cat actually already did that to us. It jumped balconies.
It was a foreign incursion.
Yes. Yeah, so now...
That shall not stand.
Retaliation is needed.
Ready the trebuchet. It's up to you if you want to use the cat and the trebuchet, but to be clear, I'm not sure if the trebuchet is being used to return the property, which would be the cat, or as an offensive measure. I'm leaving that to them.
Germ warfare.
Absolutely. Just throw the pox-infested blankets right into their laundry hamper.
I'm sure there's a better medieval weapon for this, but I have not taken that class for a long time.
Were there trebuchets in the War of the Roses? That would be a good yep. Like historical fact check.
So that was a medieval weapon, and the War of the Roses sort of took people out of the medieval ages and into the Renaissance.
Yeah, they liked their powder weapons at that point.
I think they might have moved beyond it.
Uh-huh.
I don't know. Like I said, I'm willing to be fact checked. This does remind me, since I'm making fun of the English. This does remind me of a Christmas carol, like an older English Christmas carol, that literally has in one of the lines, you know, it opens with, like, good health, love, and peace to all here in this place. Very warm, very nice, very Christmassy. And then, like, literally about four lines later, it's talking about all the things that that you're bringing to this Christmas celebration. And one of the lines is literally, we have powder and shot to conquer the lot. We have cannon and ball to conquer them all. So good health, love, and peace, and we will blow you away if you don't agree.
So you know how the War of the Roses ended? The two different sides got married.
They did. I do remember that. It was a very...
And then it was
like
well, we'll just
and that's
make
what,
a baby that's both.
Yeah, that's why the seal for a long time had a half red and half white rose.
Yeah. Yeah, so the Tudor seal is a red and white rose.
Okay.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Directly to the Henrys. Or to the Henry
I'm actually yep. learning a ton here. I know nothing about the War of the Roses.
Uh-huh.
And James, who caused his own problems.
Yeah, a bunch of them.
The kinky kind.
He did have some kinky problems that he brought forth. Yeah.
So,
well, he was
probably not
Scottish.
A lot of trebuchets because there weren't, that's like a siege weapon, and it was mostly like battlefields, not sieges. So it was mostly like bows, arrows, lances, swords, axes.
Probably more like pike and shot.
What?
Pike and shot.
I mean, this is saying like crossbows and shit.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And lots of mooning.
Well, you gotta do something to either demoralize or entice the enemy.
You want them to charge when you want them to
That's
charge.
True. And only when you say. That was point is, the War of the Roses is a very interesting period.
Yeah, it is. Like I was saying, I don't know anything about it. When we do the War of the Roses cocktail, then I'll read a whole book on it.
I think the War of the Roses cocktail should be served in doubles. And they absolutely should be thrown in the face of the other person.
There's a lot of cool historical fiction from that, too. Like the other Boleyn girl, that kind of, like all those stories are based on that time period. This was a good cocktail.
Yeah, it was.
I expected to hate it. But I like vermouth too much. I couldn't hate it.
I was afraid of it. I was thinking it was going to be bad, but...
Yeah, because like no, salt plus fire... I mean, it does usually put out a fire, but it doesn't always taste good.
Yeah. And we haven't been happy with the the Kirschwasser before, so I expected it to be another scary one. But no, David Wondrich was right. It's good. So I guess we'll wrap this up. Good cocktail, good story, lots of history on this one. We talked about lots of roses, lots of different kinds of roses. So there's going to be a lot more content like this, and we're going to keep going because there are a ton of cocktails out there. And we've only scratched the surface. We've only done old ones. We're going to start doing new ones at some point and seeing how that goes and all different kinds of stuff as the Black Liver Project grows. So keep on listening. Send us mail at blackliver@handeyemedia.net. Follow us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Look at the pretty pictures on Instagram. Every other week you'll see me posting about our episodes and giving the lowdown on each cocktail. We do focus weeks. And there's also Show Us Your Cocktail, something we do on the social medias where you get to make drinks, new ones or old ones, the ones that we're talking about, and then you can post them. And we all have a lot of fun talking about it, sharing ideas and thoughts on it. Keep on thinking and drinking. Until next time, bye now.
Can we play The Rose by Bettendler as our outro? Do we have the rights to that?
Thank you. I made that reference in the car today. And Jeremy was like, I don't know this song. And I was like, Siri, play Bettendler's The Rose. And he was like, oh yeah, I've heard this. I'm like, yeah, you have.
It was from the movie where she was not Janis Joplin.
Lay me down in a field of guns and roses where the cowboy mouth whistles me. Confess, I needed someone to help me clean up the mess. Where we lie, where we lie, where we lie. Hotel Chelsea. Suicide sounds romantic in the moment. Watch the loved ones cry from the best seats in the house. Butcher and baker, child of the corn, sleepy and naked, her body still warm. Where we
thank you for listening to the Monster in a Glass podcast. I would like to thank Jason Cruz and Nick Lehman for unraveling the history in the front part of the show, the regular tasting team Kevin Ortajczyk, Rachel Rubin, Nicole Pizzini, and Eric Martin for joining me in the grueling task of sampling each cocktail we discuss, and a special thanks to the skilled bartenders at Ward 8 in Evanston, Illinois for taming the cocktail monsters we enjoy. I would also like to thank Mark Piani for the music at the head of the show. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook, subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podomatic, and give us an awesome rating and tell us what you think while you're at it. And as always, if you're into thinking and drinking, come blacken your liver with us.